How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, we have you covered. For a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics. I'm Kira Dineen, your host. I'm also a prenatal genetic counselor. Recording of the Phenotips Speaker Series. This monthly webinar is hosted by myself, Kira Dineen, and sponsored by Phenotips. During these live events, I interview leaders in the field of genetics and moderate questions live from the audience. Check out the upcoming installments by heading over to phenotips.com, where you can also stream all the webinars from the last year and a half that we've been producing the Phenotips Speaker Series. And we hope to see you live for the next event on January 18th, where we're going to be discussing ending the diagnostic odyssey, which is a topic we've talked about extensively on DNA Today. You can register for this event via the link in the show notes or in your podcast app or on the blog post for this episode available at dnapodcast.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Phenotips Speaker Series. We have our 15th installment today, and I'm your host, Kira Dineen. Today, we're going to be diving into the future of cancer genetics. So we're going to be talking about all kinds of topics. We're going to kind of start with where we are currently, but also looking at the future of cancer genetics. To give you an overview of today's session, we're going to start by me interviewing our panelists here, and then we're going to get to your questions. So throughout the session, please submit your questions through the Zoom Q&A box, and then we will get to those at the end. But as you think of them, you know, jot them down, send them in, because we would really love to get to your questions. And I do want to mention that Phenotips is a complete solution for medical genetics. Phenotips provides software and services that ease genetic professionals' workflow. They provide tools like pedigree builders, human phenotype ontology, capture, and diagnostic insights. As we all know, electronic health records aren't built for genetics, so Phenotips fills in the gaps by providing a unified and seamless genetic workflow. In light of the pandemic, Phenotips is sponsoring this speaker series so that we can connect with fellow genetic professionals throughout the world. So this has been just an incredible experience to be able to connect with all of you and answer your questions live, very different from a lot of other podcasts. And mentioning that, Phenotips is also available as a podcast now. So you can search for it on there if that's how you like to digest your content. As I mentioned, I'm your host, Kira Dineen. I also host the DNA Today podcast. We have won the podcast award in science and medicine for the last 2 years and have produced over 160 episodes in the last 9 years. So if you enjoy today's webinar, the topics that we talk about, the level of detail that we dive into, please feel free to check out DNA Today. And I'm also a prenatal genetic counselor. But to get more importantly to our guests here today, we have two lovely guests and experts in genetics joining us. We have Dr. Banu Arun, who is the co-medical director of the Clinical Cancer Genetic Program at the University of Texas and the Anderson Cancer Center. And we also have Dr. Mark Robson, who is the chief of breast medicine service at Memorial Hospital. He's a member of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Thank you both so much for joining us live today to talk about the future of cancer genetics.
Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So I thought we would start out by talking about the current NCCN recommendations and providing a little bit of that background in case some people aren't as familiar with them. And then we can dive into a lot more details about the current and future state of cancer genetics. So what is the current NCCN recommendation on who should pursue genetic testing for hereditary cancer syndromes? Dr. Arun, would you want to start with this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the NCCN guidelines, when I started, I think, of course, I'm going to be exaggerating a little bit, was one pages. And now, you know, it's like so pages almost like any other NCCN guidelines right now. I think to really boil it down to a very practical, initial approach is that ideally we want to start testing affected individuals. obviously, if possible, you know, in the family. And then go with the youngest case, if possible. And then obviously look at into the family history. But, you know, there are certain tumor phenotypes that immediately stands out, you know, triple negative breast cancer, now all metastatic breast cancer, metastatic prostate cancer, pancreas cancer. However, the I think, you know, one really should look into the detailed guidelines, because, you know, there's some common sense that you can remember. And there are, you know, the other criteria where we build little cheat sheets for our clinics where everybody once in a while goes back and checks. And I think another thing is that it, the guidelines keep changing. So what you have read 6 months ago might have changed. So a kind of updating yourself is, I think, important.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. Dr. Robson, anything else to add to that?
Just that, you know, the NCCN guidelines don't, you know, speak to a number of different cancer predispositions, and they're all fundamentally designed to try to pick up high penetrance autosomal dominant predispositions. So Lynch syndrome, Li-Fraumeni, you know, the breast cancer syndromes. And so they're trying to describe the kinds of family configurations that might be seen with a high penetrance predisposition. And then they're mashed up with the more characteristic phenotypes, for instance, you know, choroid plexus carcinoma for Li-Fraumeni, or you know, triple negative breast cancer, like Dr. Arun mentioned. So they're a bit of a combination that's evolved over time into a kind of weird animal.
Is there anything that you would like to see added to the NCCN guidelines that you feel like we're missing patients because there's a certain aspect that really should be added, or that we should be questioning and testing more to see if that would be more inclusive of all patients, especially of patients of different ethnicities, and being more inclusive on that front?
I don't, you know, my own bias is that I don't think it's ethnicity related. I think the challenges with diversity and genetic testing are related to other factors besides the criteria themselves. I mean, sort of more social determinants than they are, that the criteria should be different for different ethnicities or you know, genetic backgrounds, ancestry backgrounds. I think the challenge becomes really, what are we trying to find? Because the NCCN guidelines are pretty good for identifying things like BRCA1, BRCA2, you know, high penetrance predispositions. They're not necessarily perfect, but they're good. And so the questions become, do they need to be perfect? Is it important to detect 100% of the BRCA mutation carriers, or can we accept some small miss rate or lack of sensitivity? And the other is, you know, which I'm sure we'll talk about more, are we going to confine ourselves to high penetrance predispositions, or are we going to start branching out? But the NCCN criteria, as they are, at least for breast cancer, I'm not really familiar elsewhere, already encompass about 50% of patients with breast cancer. So it's not like they're particularly restrictive.
And when it comes sorry, go ahead, Dr. Arun.
Sorry. It also, you know, comes down to, you know, what are you going to do with the results? I think, again, and I'm sure that question will come up. I mean, if you end up expanding, which we see every almost 6 months, it is, I think what the implications of the results, I think that's the important part.
Yeah, definitely a good preview of what we'll get into in terms of, all right, just because we're doing genetic testing, what does that actually impact in terms of clinical management for the patient? Do you want to connect with other people who have the same genetic variant as you? You should check out Connect My Variant. It's an online resource that allows you to do just that. Connect My Variant also provides different avenues of informing your family of possible inherited risk of disease. This includes helping find where your genetic variant came from and finding distant cousins that may also be at risk. The University of Washington has supported the Connect My Variant project in an effort to help patients and families understand where their genetic variants come from. Check it out at connectmyvariant.com. Do you work in reproductive genetics or cancer? Your research strategies are about to get an ultra long-range update. The new next generation cytogenomics platform from Phase Genomics uses new ultra long range genomic sequencing technology to revolutionize the reproductive genetics and precision oncology spaces. This is a platform that can generate comprehensive cytogenomic profiles of genomic structure on even the most difficult sample types, such as FFPE. By identifying balanced, unbalanced, and copy number genetic alterations, this platform combines the power of next generation sequencing with the clinical value of cytogenetics. Phase Genomics' new method can deliver an invaluable compendium of genetic information from a single sample without having to wait for results from multiple tests. Curious to learn how you can integrate ultra-long-range sequencing into your work? Start exploring at phasegenomics.com. Oh, and don't forget to stay tuned for the full episode with Phase Genomics CEO / co-founder and director of research and development on episode 169, which drops on January 28th. And in terms of genetic testing for people, as Dr. Arun mentioned, you know, usually we prefer to test in a family someone that's had cancer before, especially in early age. And Dr. Robson, back in 2019, you presented at NSGC as part of a panel about breast cancer genetic testing. And one of the questions that came up was, should all people with breast cancer have genetic testing? And this has been a question that we've been debating for years and has kind of, you know, shifted, you know, over those years. What is your viewpoint? Has this changed since that presentation 2 years ago?
I think that the point that Dr. Arun made is important. The question is, what are you going to do with the information? So if the person is, like, again, sticking with breast cancer, somebody who has metastatic disease for whom you want to consider a PARP inhibitor as a potential therapeutic option, it doesn't make sense in that setting to impose the kinds of criteria that you would use for risk assessment, right? And now, of course, in the early stage setting, high risk early stage setting, it's the same thing. And so if there is a direct treatment consequence, then I don't see barriers making sense. But right now, the only direct treatment consequences really are for BRCA1 and BRCA2. And the challenge, which I'm sure we will continue to investigate, is that it's functionally impossible to just test somebody for BRCA1 and BRCA2. So you pick up 98% of breast cancer, BRCA1, BRCA2 mutations if you just cut off at age 65, and 40% of breast cancer occurs after that age. So at least from a cost effectiveness standpoint, you do really well if you limit yourself by age. But you do miss moderate penetrance genes, or fail to test for moderate penetrance genes. And that is, to some people's eye, a problem, and to other people's eye, not. So that's where the controversy lies.
Dr. Arun, anything else to add to this? I know there's another level of this conversation of, should we be doing population-based screening, which is even more than just everyone with breast cancer, which that's a little bit more of an aggressive approach. But any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you touched base on something, especially related to population screening. I think Dr. Robson really covered it well, but what I wanted to add related to population screening is, you know, the issue might be to do when you have uninformative negatives. So, you know, and most probably when we do population screening, most probably it's going to be without really counseling, consumer-directed testing, so that this whole discussion about what to do with the results, the expected results, and a uninformative negative, especially if you end up testing, you know, not the appropriate person in the family.
Yeah, I think that's well said, and looking at the full picture of it, of not just, okay, can we find a bunch of people that have a genetic change that's increasing their risk for cancer, but like, how does that affect them? When it comes to healthcare providers that are ordering this testing and ordering the genetic testing and choosing a lab, what should they keep in mind in terms of what aspects of a lab, you know, I'm thinking like turnaround time, limitations of testing, like what should healthcare providers keep in mind that maybe are not ordering genetic testing as much as other providers or are new to it?
you want.
Either you want to take that one.
I don't know, Bennett, you want to take it?
I can start. I mean, I think, you know, we have the luxury of having several companies available to choose from. I think, again, it goes back to, you know, in what setting you are requesting it. So if it's for, you know, pre-surgical or management, you know, you want the results right away. And sometimes our genetic counselors, for example, choose by turnaround time, you know, insurance coverage. So there are actually multiple factors. I think in terms of technology, I think, they are all, very similar and accurate. However, I think there are these little clinical details that can help choose one over the other. I don't know, Mark, if you wanted to add something.
The only thing I'll add is that there are a few offerings that are beyond the big genetic testing companies, and I think we all know who the big ones are. But there are occasionally cases where you'll have kind of local labs trying to do things. Because next generation sequencing is quite honestly not that complicated. I mean, you know, most academic centers can probably do it. The challenge becomes variant curation. And there are electronic offerings, sort of, you know, decision aids that are just software plugs. And if you don't set the levers right, you can get a wrong answer. And I can tell an anecdote about a woman who we got off the runway with K3326X because, you know, she'd been called pathogenic at one of these small labs because they basically forgot to flip a switch. And it was just a miracle that we caught it before she had her prophylactic mastectomy. So I think if you stick with the big ones, you'll be all right. And if you kind of are doing it outside of that context, you have to look a little bit more deeply into their quality control measures and curation measures.
And when we do have VUSs come up, unfortunately, this is happening quite often. I mean, how should this be evaluated in terms of how often we should check back if it is a true VUS? How often patients should check back or healthcare providers on if it's been reclassified? And where does that responsibility lie? Is it with the patients or is it with the healthcare providers? Dr. Arun, did you want to provide some insight on this?
Yeah, I can get started. I think that is a very important question that comes, you know, in the clinical setting. I think I want to say that there's really no standard of care approach, unfortunately, right now. There's no, you know, systematic approach where everybody does the same thing. So that means, you know, everybody and each institution has developed their own practical guidelines or workflow, if you will. We, for example, stay obviously in touch with the companies. So updates come to our genetic counselors. And many of our patients remain our patients, long-term patients, our cancer patients, because of the nature of our institution. And I'm sure it's similar with Dr. Robson as well. So there's this communication flowing where we really don't have to go back and check. If we notice that a patient hasn't been seen for some time and we haven't heard from the labs, we periodically check, but usually we get informed. But the issue is a widespread, you know, it's a widespread issue. And unfortunately, there is no standard. And I think a lot of institutions or smaller practices are doing a hybrid where hopefully the provider tells the patient, you know, these VUSs can get upgraded. Let's remind each other, I'll check with the lab. So in some cases, I think the lab reaches out to the provider or the patient asks. So it's I think, a hybrid form, but it's not an optimal form, obviously.
Yeah, and I work in prenatal, so I'm not directly in cancer, but obviously sometimes that comes up and, you know, patients will ask me like, how often should I check back? And so recently I've been saying 6 months. Do you think that that's a good recommendation? Should it be more frequent, less frequent?
That is a good question. We just analyzed our internal data, which is not published yet, but I can just tell you in general, we looked at the data, not only ours, but our community practicing sites in the US and the US reclassification rate. Now, I cannot go into details right now, it's not published, but what we've seen is that the reclassification percentage is much more, you know, frequent over the last several years compared to more than 5 years ago. So I think I want to say at least once a year, if not every 6 months, because of the technology and the increasing data, right? It's you know, the more data comes in, the more the classifications are easier, in addition to all of the, you know, other technology advancements. So at least once a year, and if you can do 6 months, you know, that's fine too. But again, there's no written rule. But what I can say is that the updates and the reclassifications are happening more frequently over the last 3 years compared to the prior 3 years, at least in our data set. That is like a little representation from different geographical areas in the US.
And Dr. Robson, to bring you into this, do you think that we're gonna get guidelines at some point? Because obviously the US has been an issue for years. And, you know, as we've been talking about, we kind of say, well, this is what we think we should do. And it's kind of clinic by clinic. But do you think we're going to have, like NCCN or maybe part of it, of saying, okay, yes, like patients should are referred to check back in on, you know, this many months, a year, or like, you know, on the healthcare provider side, they are supposed to give an update to patients or check in with labs? Or are we going to see this in the future, you think?
I very much doubt that there'll be a policy statement around it, because it could potentially leave people exposed, and you know, likelihood of that is not good. I mean, if somebody doesn't necessarily read like a, you know, ACSG or, you know, something like that, ACMG statement, then, you know, they could be getting in trouble. So I don't think documentation of standard of care is likely. I think, you know, although reclassification is getting a little bit better, I mean, my experience, and I don't know if this is Dr. Darun's experience, is that it still tends to be more downgrading than upgrading. And so, you know, the importance of notifying somebody of a downgrade, if you've counseled them appropriately up front, is kind of limited, right? If you've told them not to use this information for decision-making and just screen or take action based on family history, then the fact that they've been downgrading shouldn't have an impact. Upgrades, I think it's hard. And if we think broadly, I mean, you know, we're all experienced people. I mean, Dr. Aaron and I work at major centers and you know, have large numbers of genetic counselors who do this exclusively. But if you think about the practitioner who's in the middle of the country, who basically just ordered this on his own or her own, expecting that person to be able to manage reclassification and check ClinVar or BRCA challenge or whatever they want to check and make a decision that now they should notify, that feels like an unfair expectation. So the laboratory should be communicating upgrades to the ordering physician. And I think an annual check-in by the patient is probably fine. Of course, if you find something, if you do get an upgrade, then you should reach out before then. But otherwise, I don't think we should be assuming the responsibility for tracking all of these.
Are you a genetic counselor or genetic counseling student? Join me in participating in a research study surrounding the education on gender-affirming care in genetic counseling. This study is from the University of Michigan Genetic Counseling Program. It requires a pre- and post-test survey, along with an online 2 to 3 hour educational tool. I just got access to the modules, and I'm looking forward to learning more this week. And here's a bonus, you are entered to win one of 10 $50 gift cards. So complete the survey via the link in the show notes, which is also available at dnapodcast.com. Did you know PerkinElmer Genomics was one of the first laboratories to offer whole genome sequencing on a clinical basis?
Whole genome sequencing can maximize clinical diagnostic yield for patients. With a turnaround time of 6 weeks, PerkinElmer's whole genome sequencing test is designed to provide access to additional valuable information compared to an exome. PerkinElmer Genomics provides one of the world's most comprehensive programs for detecting clinically significant genomic changes. PerkinElmer Genomics delivers knowledge that can empower health. PerkinElmer is a global leader committed to innovating for a healthier world. Join their mission at PerkinElmerGenomics.com. And also, stay tuned for our interview with PerkinElmer, where we're going to be exploring the power of whole genome sequencing. I'll also tease that my guest for this episode is a world-renowned geneticist, so you are not going to want to miss this one. But while you wait for the episode, head over to PerkinElmerGenomics.com to start discovering all PerkinElmer has to offer.
And you mentioned earlier the case that you had where you were able to intervene on someone that was about to get a risk-reducing surgery because of a VUS. Unfortunately, this happens more often than it should. It's very scary to hear just how many people that, you know, are found to have a VUS and have a risk-reducing surgery from that. How can we reduce this from happening, of people having these unnecessary surgeries?
I mean, we've been trying to educate people for 25 years. I mean, you know, we've been trying to assure people that VUS doesn't mean you should act. And I think that there's just, unfortunately, among some people, particularly those who are perhaps a little bit less experienced with genetic testing, or, you know, it's just kind of when there's smoke, there must be fire kind of attitude. And then the patients themselves sometimes bring that attitude as well, right? Especially if they haven't had good post-test genetic counseling, they may themselves actually bring that, you know, that anxiety to it and just want to be, quote, safe rather than sorry, end quote. You know? So it's hard to combat that mindset of risk avoidance. Because you can't tell them that it won't be upgraded. And you know, if you've seen it in two family members who had breast cancer, and you know, you can explain the genetics till the cows come home, the person may just think, you know, I don't want to take a chance.
Yeah, I think that's a good point as well. Dr. Arun, what do you have to add here?
Yeah, I just wanted to add the patient perspective, I think is very important in VUS also. If you think about breast cancer patients, especially in the US with unilateral breast cancer, even in the absence of any germline mutation, not only VUS, they choose to undergo double mastectomies. So, I mean, if a patient with, you know, curable small one-sided breast cancer chooses to do double mastectomies just without a mutation, you can imagine that hearing about the VUS, even though they are told we don't know the functionality and whether it's a disease-causing change, it's not that difficult for those very motivated patients to just decide for these mastectomies. I think it might be interesting and important to see what makes them make that decision. Is it the VUS or is it just the breast cancer and they don't want to have contralateral breast cancer? We don't have that data. But I think in some of the VUS cases where we hear about these surgeries, It might not be the VUS actually, you know, the desire to prevent a future new cancer. Now, of course, that does not answer the rare unfortunate cases where some patients even undergo preventive oophorectomies. Very rarely we have seen that also, and hoping that it is not happening often.
Yeah, I think that's important to always keep in mind the patient perspective and see what other factors are playing a role. Because say, you know, their mother or aunt or someone had breast cancer and had that VUS in their mind, they're like, well, you know, it really could be related. And even if there is such a small chance, that's a choice that they're making. So certainly in some cases, maybe that is in the patient's best interest. And, you know, it would be interesting to see a study of like, you know, of that, of VUSs, like what are the other factors that are playing a role in that decision-making. Maybe someone out there could do a study on that. But the other question I had with VUSs, which we kind of touched on a little bit earlier, is, you know, the racial disparity with VUSs and detection rates, you know, especially for people of non-European descent. I don't know if either of you have any thoughts on how we can, you know, work towards eliminating these disparities. Obviously, a lot of genetic testing and our databases are based primarily of people of European descent. But this is a major problem in genetics. And just if either of you have any thoughts on how we can continue to eliminate this.
So it's an interesting question, and I think it's a multifactorial problem. You know, there's just the simple observation that there aren't enough people of non-European ancestry being tested to build up an experience of basically allele frequency to kind of help you exclude pathogenicity. You know, Ambry, one of the big companies, published a review of their multi-gene panel testing, like 165,000 individuals tested, and only 6.5% were of self-reported African ancestry. And so that's about half, maybe less than half of the population frequency. So clearly, you know, there are disparities, but they may be economic as much as they are racial or you know, ancestry-based. Because you know, Alison Curian did a study also looking at it in the SEER databases in Georgia and California. And she actually didn't find a difference in prevalence of testing by self-declared race, but did find differences by residents in poverty tracts, right? So poor people just didn't get access. And then there's among some subpopulations, particularly the African-American subpopulation, there's just a phenomenal amount of mistrust, right? I mean, they don't necessarily have access to the same types of genetic counseling, particularly if they're in safety net hospitals or something like that, which isn't, you know, it's not fair to say that that's necessarily where African ancestry folks get care, but clearly, you know, a number do. And then, so they don't get genetics explained to them well, and there's just a little bit of mistrust that, you know, is this research and what are you doing? And I think that plays in as well.
Anything else to add to that, Dr. Aaron?
No, I think Dr. Robson really covered it really well.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot more work we need to do in this area.
Yeah. Yep.
And touching back to, you know, what we've talked about before in terms of, you know, what we're actually doing with clinical management based on genetic testing results, we've kind of been dancing around this. So to jump into it, as we've mentioned, there's different genes, I mean, variants can have various cancer risks. So some may have a 20% risk of, you know, we've been using breast cancer as an example, and others might, you know, have up to an 85% risk. How does this change clinical management? Is there like a magic number in terms of when we would recommend certain management, you know, in terms of their lifetime risk of breast cancer? Dr. Arun, if you wanted to start kind of providing a little bit of just background on this.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, we circle back to the guidelines because at least it has some type of quantification. Because when we especially are trying to talk about the cutoffs and what to do with the results, we need to have some type of reference that can be communicated to, you know, wider communities. If we do everything just case-based, then the discussions will be all over and, you know, we have to find somehow a minimum agreed upon, you know, threshold. So for, again, breast cancer example, you know, if lifetime risk is 20% or higher, for example, you know, we know that we can offer MRI screening in addition to mammograms. But again, you know, it depends on the concept. So if you have a patient with a PALP2 or BRCA mutation, then, you know, the recommendations are considering, you know, encouraged to do the MRIs. But if you have a CHEK2 mutation, it's, again, the lifetime risk is more than 20%, but it's a softer recommendation. So we have the cutoff of 20%, but I think it depends on the clinical scenario. Obviously with CHEK2, the language is a little bit softer, but because it's greater than 20% and it's somehow mentioned in the guidelines, a lot of people don't differentiate and just do it. But I, for example, discuss it with my older, you know, check to mutation carriers that it's an option out there, and not everybody needs an MRI. But I think from the practical approach, whether we agree it's 19% or 23.5% or 27%, I think it's good to have a number, because I think the insurance goes by that as well. And at least there is some type of agreement amongst any type of provider in any type of setting, academic or private or smaller community places.
Yeah, I think, and you also bring up a good point with the insurance side, at least in the US, of if people do have genetic testing that shows that there is an increased risk for breast cancer, insurance is more likely to kick in and cover more surveillance. Dr. Robson, anything else to add to this?
I mean, it's another, like everything here, there's a lot of complexity and nuance, right? So the 20% threshold is just an arbitrary number that was pulled out of thin air by the American Cancer Society back in the 1990s. And like much that's gone on with this whole field, there was sort of, the guidelines followed the clinical observations, right? I mean, people said, okay, MRI works. Who should we use it in? And somebody just picks out a thin air. Well, how about 20% risk? You know, and that's how it gets started. And same thing with NCCN guidelines for moderate penetrance mutations, right? We're finding moderate penetrance mutations, and people say, well, what should we do? And say, well, NCCN says do this. So it's not driven by evidence of efficacy, but it is what it is. We've got it. My sense is that there's a couple of different categories. There are people who have clear high penetrance, autosomal dominant predispositions. And again, I zoom out beyond just breast and think about colon and other disorders, colon in particular. And for them, it's pretty obvious what to do. You know, you follow high-risk screening guidelines. And quite frankly, for those people, if the syndrome is enough of a predisposition, surgery becomes an appropriate option. And then at the other end, or in the middle, I guess, of the spectrum, you have these so-called moderate penetrance variants, which confer considerably lower risks. You know, we say 2 to 5-fold, but the fact is most of them are around 2-fold. And I emphasize those are 2-fold average risks, because the risk associated with alterations in these genes are much more subject to modification by other factors like polygenic background and, you know, quantitative risk factors, mammographic density, such that there are certainly people, even though they have an average risk of 20% or greater, probably personally have a lower risk and perhaps even a lower risk than population. So you can't take that one size fits all. And in general, in the absence of a strong family history that suggests this autosomal dominant predisposition, you wouldn't want to do surgery either, right? And then you have another category of genes which wind up on these huge 80, 90 gene panels, which aren't necessarily even clearly associated with cancer risk at all. You know, some study has shown an increased risk, which has not necessarily been verified in other studies, and it just kind of winds up on there. And for them, you probably shouldn't take any incremental action, period. You should just treat people on the basis of family history and age. So the biggest challenge for me is there a threshold for surgery? And we were talking about this, I think, when we were talking about the contralateral mastectomy problem. And, you know, surgery, quite frankly, is a personal utility decision. You know, there's some talk about contralateral mastectomy improving outcomes in BRCA, but I don't think that's a generalizable observation. So who's to say what the threshold should be?
I think, as you said, that is a very personal decision, and that's why we need healthcare providers to sit down and talk through all of this information. So patients are really, you know, a major part of that decision-making, and we're not saying, oh, anybody that has this risk, they should get the surgery. Like it's going to be a case by case.
Did you know that most cancer samples cannot be subjected to some of the most common cytogenetic analysis due to their storage in formalin and other intractable storage conditions? Don't let difficult sample types and convoluted assay cascades get in the way of your research. Phase Genomics has developed a brand new next-generation cytogenomics platform to advance discovery in reproductive genetics and precision oncology. A single assay has the ability to do comprehensive testing for chromosome abnormalities in fresh, frozen, and even paraffin-embedded FFPE samples. Learn more about Phase Genomics' incredible new platform, InsightoGenomics, by visiting phasegenomics.com. You can also hear our in-depth interview with them on episode 169 of DNA Today, which will be released on January 28th. Have you done a genetic test and discovered you have a mutation or pathogenic variant, as we genetic counselors call them? One of the next steps is to inform your family they are at risk of also carrying the variant. Telling relatives about their risk can save lives, but these can also be tough conversations to have. Luckily, Connect My Variant offers resources to help, including ways to communicate results with suggested language. Whether you want to talk to your aunt or email a third cousin, Connect My Variant can help. You are not alone. Connect My Variant can connect you with others who have the same exact variant. Growing a network of people with the exact same variant who know about it can help your family members understand the impact of your genetic variant and the steps for them to get tested and to prevent disease. If you want to discover where your variant came from and learn more about what it means for your family, explore and sign up at connectmyvariant.com. Again, that's connectmyvariant.com.
Another aspect of this, we've been talking about, you know, family history and then specific genetic mutations, but there's a whole nother level to this with polygenic risk scores that have really been becoming much more popular, not only in the cancer realm, but just in general. You know, when we're looking at cancer risk models, they've started being incorporated. Dr. Arun, what do you think is the clinical utility of the polygenic risk scores? Is there one now? Is this more in the future? Like, where are we at right now with polygenic risk scores and using them?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I will take a little bit more conservative stand here. I think it will really help in the future fine-tuning the risk inform us about whether a plant intervention will work. I think that is the missing part right now. You know, we have the technology. I think the calibration, especially how the results will impact an intervention, such as chemo prevention, for example. You know, if these patients with a certain polygenic score take tamoxifen, are we reducing their risk of breast cancer? That is important. Or whether, you know, those risk scores can help with surgical decision-making, for example. So it needs to provide us with a fine-tuning information and help with the challenges that we face in the clinic. Because yes, tamoxifen is, you know, indicated to discuss for chemo prevention. We discuss preventive surgeries. We discuss increased imaging. Or frequency of imaging or MRI modalities, but the devil is in the details. So which patients are the ones that will actually benefit from that? And I think that information right now is not available. I think that's my only concern right now, but if that data is in, then I think it can really help with fine tuning and maybe personalizing the interventions for to manage risk.
That's more on the future side from your perspective. Dr. Robson, you agree? You think, yeah, we should be using this now?
I'm more kind of intellectually convinced by the polygenic risk scores. I mean, there's been a huge amount of work done developing the both empiric data regarding risk and the actual data regarding combination and what their effects are on modifying risk. And it's you know, it's very clear that the effect is real in particular circumstances. It's been shown that the risk is independent or largely independent of the other risk models that we're used to using. And, you know, true calibration studies are coming out now using combination scores. The challenge is that we don't believe them, right? I mean, you know, you have somebody who comes in who's got a minimal family history and you get their polygenic risk score and they don't have a rare variant, but still the polygenic risk score tells you that their risk is 35 to 40%. And we just don't want to believe that. And we also don't want to de-escalate care if they do have a family history or say they do have a rare check two variant and the combined score tells us that their risk is actually less than 20%. We don't want to quote unquote deny them an MRI. So I don't think the problem is with the science. I think the problem is one of how do you get people comfortable using it? And particularly for the folks who actually have particularly high polygenic risk scores, you know, that is worrisome. But, you know, 5% of the population is going to be above two standard deviations, right? I mean, that's just the way it works. So some people are going to have high scores when you do it that way. And perhaps more breast cancer comes about in those people than actually comes about in the rare variant carriers.
Yeah, that's interesting just to look at, okay, well, polygenic risk score, how many people are being picked up from that versus like these moderate penetrant, you know, gene mutations that we've been talking about. So it seems like in the near future, maybe we'd be incorporating that a little bit more, but that, I don't know if we're going to get to a point of just doing polygenic risk scores alone. I think we're always going to be combining it with hopefully family history and these other, you know, autosomal dominant genetic mutations that we've been talking about. And the other aspect that we've mentioned is doing, you know, obviously germline testing we've been talking about a lot, but the other side of it is doing somatic genetic testing to see, okay, is there any, like, what are the genetic changes in the cancer and how does that affect, you know, care? When is it appropriate to order both germline and somatic genetic testing? Is there times we're just doing somatic genetic testing? Dr. Arun, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think the, you know, indications and also partially obviously implications of the results are different. I think one has to really differentiate, like, what information do you want to get from the test? So I want to mention that if your intention is germline testing, then you do only germline testing. But if your intention is to do somatic testing, that automatically actually comes with the germline testing too. So, you know, that you can do the calling. So that part is a little bit more complicated, but the indications for the somatic testing, if it's pure somatic, is currently it's mostly metastatic, you know, advanced cancers for therapeutic implications. And the indications for that is, you know, it's a whole other discussion, but you know, since you are focusing on your patient, on your patient's management, and now we have a targetable mutations and agents available, I think any metastatic, you know, cancer patient, and I'm now talking beyond breast cancer, actually, you know, mostly used beyond breast cancer anyway, and breast cancer is now, you know, up and coming, any metastatic patient, for either standard of care, targeted therapies, or clinical trial enrollments, so phase one, phase two trials, and now some phase three trials as well. It should be considered for those. Where the convergence of with germline and genetics come in is, you know, the incidental findings, of course, that then ideally requires reflex germline testing, clinical germline testing to confirm. Right now, the germline testing does not have any major therapeutic implications for many cancers, except for BRCA, for PARP inhibitors, for some solid tumors. But the rest really will be germline information for the family. But that is where they really, you know, intersect. And that raises the next question. I'm sure, you know, it will come up where you'll ask us, like, how do you then manage the process, you know, an oncologist seeing a metastatic lung cancer patient just focus on targeted, you know, therapies, and all of a sudden there is an incidental BRCA mutation. And then, you know, that oncologist has to shift his or her whole attention and discussion a little bit towards the germline and family and clinical testing and so forth. So that raises, of course, like, how do you manage, you know, this information through a process fast also, because, you know, the treatment still has to happen. But then now you have the family also. So those are, I don't think there's the best way to do it, but, you know, those are the issues that are discussed with the genetics and germline or somatic, you know, genetic discussion.
Yeah, it certainly brings up just so much because you don't know what you're going to find. It's not necessarily like, oh, you know, we're finding this change and that's just going to mean we're doing this medication. As you said, incidental findings come up all the time. And, you know, are these patients really getting the proper pretest counseling to know that that can come up? Because certainly I think if they're meeting with a genetics healthcare provider, I would say they are, but maybe they're not. So I think that that brings up a good point with that. Dr. Robson, anything else to add in terms of like somatic versus germline testing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I don't think that this is that complicated, honestly. I mean, I for patients with advanced disease, and you can define that however you want, depending on the disease site. In my view is that everybody should have, paired tumor normal sequencing at that time. And you can do it. You know, we've been doing this routinely here now for several years with, I can't remember how many thousand people. I mean, we're somewhere up around 15,000 people. And, the number of people who've asked for pretest genetic counseling is like one, maybe two. And the way we do it is we do tumor normal sequencing as our standard way of tumor court characterization. It's not an incidental finding. We explicitly consent patients to germline with a very brief introductory video. And then if there is a finding, the primary care doctor basically tells the patient, there's a finding, and then hands them off over to the genetics team to do the post-test counseling and family expansion. And I think that this can be done in a number of different ways. I mean, it can be supported. I mean, we have obviously are able to support it internally, but if you're somewhere else in the country, it could be supported remotely, because you just need to jack somebody into a genetic counseling network so that they can get the post-test education and then have their family members directed towards testing. So, it's been very successful for us. We have not had, we haven't had any experiences with people feeling, dramatically upset about finding something or and as a matter of fact, they've been pretty grateful that with their metastatic disease, they haven't had to go through the whole, genetic counseling pretest process, which can be quite burdensome for somebody who's very sick. And, we find germline alterations in about 17 to 18% of all patients with advanced metastatic disease, and not necessarily just those who you might expect based on phenotype. Fully half of those are in people who wouldn't have been tested based on phenotype or family history. So I think that this will happen. It's just a matter of, again, getting people around to it.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And that interesting that you're your institution's taking advantage of different service delivery models that you said patients will watch an informative video before doing the testing. And then if something comes up in that, where you said a little less than 20% of patients meeting with a genetic counselor at that point, just for, it sounds like efficiency, but also like they're getting the information, they're watching the video. So they're still being informed at that point. What other alternative service delivery models do you think are really effective with cancer genetics? I mean, there's so many out there now with chatbots and group genetic counseling.
I don't think the chatbots works. So I'll tell you,
when
when the chatbot first came out, I went to one of the companies that was rolling out a chatbot, and I just decided to play with it a little bit. And so, I signed up for an account. And I'm going through it all.
Yeah.
I know. And I said, so what happens if I feel like killing myself after getting my test? This test has different meanings for different people. no, seriously, I'm kind of depressed. Should I get this test? It was just useless. I mean, it was completely useless.
On the human emotion side, I don't know how good it, maybe like the information side might be okay, but.
Right, yeah. But the actual counseling side, it's not particularly useful. Anyway, yeah. That's my kind of thing, is to mess with AI, but.
We've all done it.
But I think the remote counseling model is a good one. Remote work in general is kind of becoming more of a thing. And I guess the main barrier to this is cross state line licensing, right? Which of course is a problem for physician telehealth as well. But if you had a model, and there are companies that do this where they basically have counselors who are signed up to participate in kind of a part-time type of model, and then they can try to pair people with appropriate licensure to get this stuff delivered. And I think it works fine. for most people. I don't think it necessarily has to be hand-to-hand in person.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the pandemic has really changed just the ability of people being able to access telehealth.
PerkinElmer Genomics is a global leader in genetic testing focusing on rare diseases, inherited disorders, newborn screening, and hereditary cancer. Testing services support the full continuum of care from preconception and prenatal to neonatal, pediatric, and adult. Testing options include sequencing for targeted genes, multiple genes, the whole exome or genome, and copy number variations. Using a simple saliva or blood sample, PerkinElmer Genomics answers complex genetic questions that can proactively inform patient care and end the diagnostic odyssey for families. Learn more at PerkinElmerGenomics.com. Are you a genetic counselor or genetic counseling student? Then I invite you to participate in a research study surrounding education on gender-affirming care in genetic counseling. This is being conducted by Gabrielle Ernest, a student from the University of Michigan Genetic Counseling Program. The goal of this research study is to improve gender-affirming healthcare in genetic counseling through education and knowledge application. There are three parts to the study. The first is a 10 to 15 minute survey to gauge your understanding of gender-affirming care. The second is an online 2 to 3 hour educational tool to further your learning, especially in the prenatal setting. And the third is a 10 to 15 minute post-educational survey to assess what you've learned. I've done the pre-survey and I'm excited to dive into the modules this week. There's also an opportunity to connect during a workshop. This will entail interacting with members of the transgender and or gender diverse community surrounding the practices of gender-affirming care for the clinic. And here's a bonus. Participants will be entered to win one of 10 $50 gift cards. So complete the survey via the link in the show notes, which is also available at dnapodcasts.com.
Dr. Arun, anything else to add in terms of service delivery models, if you're also not a fan of chatbots or?
Yeah, I mean, the chat box, we are not very familiar, to be honest. You know, I did not do that little test drive like
I played with
now
it.
I'm intrigued, you know, I want to do that. But what I wanted to go back to that Dr. Robson mentioned, you know, the video is also an alternative that you can use. We at our institution have implemented several different models. We do the traditional face-to-face. We do, of course, the remote, which we had started before the pandemic with some of our satellite sites, telegenetics with or without video, so phone or video, which then turned into during COVID into a real video visit. But then we also have the without the counselor, pre-testing, watching video counseling information, and especially in high volume, low hanging fruit clinics, for example, testing all metastatic prostate cancer patients in the GU center. So we actually had implemented that several years ago. Patients watch a video. We had recorded it in English and Spanish. And then by our genetic counselors team, we updated every 2 years or as needed. And then since taking a family history for those indications is not very, very crucial, after watching the video, the patient could ask for a traditional genetic counseling visit, but almost none of them did and agreed and signed consent for the testing. And then we would do the back-end counseling with the counselor for positives or VUSs. So we somehow have multiple modalities in different clinics based on need and turnaround time. And we will continue trying to explore these models. And some of them can be then used as examples for other setting outside our institution.
Yeah, definitely. I think when you think about just during a genetic counseling session, how much of it is spent just explaining concepts that could be maybe even better done in a video where you have aids, things are moving, patients are engaged a little bit more. That just seems to kind of make sense with that model. Dr. Robson, what else do you have to add?
I was just going to riff on this a little bit because Dr. Aaron said something I think is very important, which is that you can fit the delivery model to the purpose. right? So you know, metastatic prostate cancer, newly diagnosed ovarian cancer, you know, triple negative breast cancer. I mean, you know, you don't necessarily need a lot of interaction for most patients to get the testing done. Our big experience that I describe is largely with metastatic cancer. I think that's a very different thing than the young woman who wants to have a conversation because she has a family history, right? I mean, I think that that still is very much a traditional model. And the dividing line for me is therapeutic implication versus personal utility. You know, I mean, direct therapeutic implication versus personal utility. And I still think that if you are largely doing things for personal utility, yes, screening, but mainly it's does somebody want to know, then the traditional counseling model should still be employed. And the others really should be concentrated on these therapeutic settings.
And seeing that there's multiple tracks that could be taken. It's like, okay, this patient fits this track. Let's have them do this. Like, watch the video. If they have questions, meet with genetic counselor. Others, maybe skip that, as you said. So kind of adapt it to whatever the situation is. And, you know, I think patients appreciate too, when they have a little bit less appointments of, okay, watch this video instead of booking an appointment. You have to be somewhere in person, parking, getting there, taking time off from work. Definitely a lot of factors with that. And I'm going to get to our audience questions in just a couple minutes. So make sure everybody that you are popping your questions into the Q&A box here in Zoom. And I'm excited to get to those questions. But before I do, I wanted to ask you guys, what else are the major barriers of cancer genetics that we're currently facing? Is there anything we haven't talked about yet that is really an issue in the field that, you know, we need to be working on, that healthcare providers need to be aware of, or just what you've experienced in the field? Any issues that you see maybe on the horizon? Dr. Arun, anything strike your mind when thinking about this?
Yeah, I think we maybe didn't discuss a lot. I think we maybe touched base a little bit, but the whole germline world is, and the guidelines, there is so much information coming in, whether it's technologies, indications, what to do with the results, what other genes are added to the panel. So I think one important aspect, which is a whole other, I think, discussion, is how to disseminate this information to healthcare providers. And we have to think beyond oncologists, of course, and we have been saying this, you know, for a long time, internists, gynecologists, I mean, wherever the patients are, you know, are being either counseled or getting the testing. You know, there are some studies, we have done some where genetic testing or screening is implemented in mammography centers, for example, because when women come in for screening, or primary care offices, for example. But how do you reach out to these or disseminate the knowledge? And it's a dynamic thing, right? It keeps changing to these healthcare providers, especially primary care, when, you know, so much is changing. I mean, you know, all of the guidelines and cardiovascular and smoking cessation and everything, they deal with so many, you know, algorithms and guidelines and indications. I think that is an area that I think we have to do work on.
Definitely. There's so much to be keeping healthcare providers updated on, especially as you said, like in a GP setting, they have so much to keep up with. This small area of genetic testing is not going to be maybe top on their list. So yeah, I think that highlights a lot of the current barriers that we're facing. Anything else, Dr. Robson, that you think of?
You know, I don't know why I'm feeling sort of provocative today, but I think that
we love it. Go for it.
Yeah. It's sort of, you know, Dr. Arun has been around me a lot to know that when you have me on a call for more than 30 minutes, I start getting kind of rambunctious. So I actually think that we're just making it too complicated, that if we just did genetic and genomic characterization of cancer patients with cancer genetics backup, genetic counseling backup to interpret results, and then use that to cascade into families. You know, the upfront oncology teams and to a lesser extent, the surgical teams are educable in terms of, you know, cancer genetics, particularly if they have genetic counselors there to help interpretation of results. And then, you know, a cascade approach as opposed to a population screening approach, you know, avoids many of the problems that you're alluding to in terms of, you know, undereducation, lack of time on the primary care part, you know, risk of circumventing informed consent for the unaffected. You know, can you imagine a world, you know, population screening? How do you do population screening? Every woman on her 25th birthday at her GYN appointment gets a panel sent? I mean, is that what it's going to be? I mean, I don't think so. But on the other hand, every woman at their GYN appointment at age 25 is not going to get referred to a genetic counselor for a discussion. So the more effective way in is to have the cancer patient be the index point and just relax the testing criteria for the cancer patients and then move it forward from there. So that's my radical proposal.
Just simplify it. Just have it be a little bit less complicated.
Quit with the one from column A, three from column B. You know, if it's Thursday, then they can get genetic testing and just work it from the cancer standpoint.
Yeah. And then if there is a genetic variant identified in a patient that's pathogenic, then cascade testing, as you're saying, of testing other individuals in the family.
Right. And have the, you know, concentrate the genetics resources on those people, not on the upfront screening of large numbers of people, most of whom are not going to have variants, right?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And taking advantage of like the videos that we've been talking about and different ways to educate that are not putting a strain on healthcare providers as much too. So I want to jump into some questions that we have. We have some that were previously submitted and some submitted in the moment. So if you're listening right now or watching and you have questions, feel free to pop them in the Q&A box. We're going to get to as many as we can in the next 15 minutes here. So our first question is, with the current situation presented by both speakers about overeager patients, what are your thoughts on utilizing personal health records that improves access to personal genetic information, but may perhaps have unintended consequences where patients take unnecessary risks? I don't know if either of you have thoughts on this.
So, you know, the patient is not going to be able to do her own mastectomy. Right. So just because she has access to the information, somebody else has to participate in the unnecessary risk. And I don't think, you know, personally withholding that information from him or her, I mean, we keep talking about her, but it can be both, is necessary in order to avoid harm. What's necessary is to make sure the surgeon doesn't do harm.
And anything else to add to that, Dr. Arun?
No, I think I agree. I mean, you know, knowledge, I think patients have their rights to have access all the time. And if not given because of the fear that it might be overused, that's the wrong thing, then that, you know, there's a problem and that needs to be solved and not just, you know, not having access. I don't think that's a solution.
Yeah, definitely. And another question we have is, how can healthcare providers stay updated on the changes in cancer genetics? Do you have any resources to recommend? Because as we've been talking about, there is just so many changes. I mean, with NCCN guidelines, every 6 months, it seems like from my perspective that they're being updated. So any other resources to look at in terms of just knowing what's going on with cancer genetics and especially just the big headlines?
I mean, it's just, you know, what we discussed a few minutes ago, you know, I'm presenting the complicated, you know, path, and Dr. Robson just, you know, offering this, let's just make it simple. But I mean, you know, there are obviously, you know, several resources. I mean, NCCN, ASCO, genetic societies. I mean, it's out there. But the problem is that how do you access it fast enough? And, you know, keep, you know, staying updated all the time. I think that's the thing, because and, you know, and the guidelines and the information varies sometimes, you know, from place to place. Then you have to compare this to that, you know, the USPSTF guidelines are a little bit different, you know, than the others. So I think it's all time. I mean, you know, healthcare providers, you know, we are smart people, we know, but it's the time and how to implement that in your everyday busy life. So let's make it simple, like Mark said.
Make it simple. I think that's the theme for today's webinar. Any other resources to add there, Dr. Robson?
No, I mean, I'm not sure that it, the expectation is fair. Cancer genetics, if you start rolling in somatic cancer genetics as well as germline cancer genetics, this is a hugely complicated and exponentially growing field. It's a specialized field of knowledge, just like thoracic oncology is a specialized field of knowledge, or colorectal oncology is. I don't understand how general oncologists keep up with everything that's going on now. It just seems impossible to me. And so I think what the generalist, whether they be an oncologist or not, just has to recognize is sort of, when should somebody go get some help, right? And so for the unaffected person, my sense is that it probably should just be if they're interested. If they have a family history and they're interested in learning about it, we should have ways that they learn in graded fashion, perhaps with like some sort of video to start with, and then referral to genetic counseling afterwards. And as I said, for the affecteds, I just think we should have a very low threshold for testing, but with appropriate backup, which is what I really want to emphasize. You can't just do it and assume that the person's going to know what to do with the answer. You have to have appropriate backup.
Yeah, definitely. And another question is, CRISPR is a game changer when it comes to genetic editing. How has this technology been used in cancer? Are there any notable clinical trials so far, or is this more in the future?
Yeah, I think it's in the future. As good as CRISPR is for laboratory experiments, I'm not so sure that it's ready for people experiments. There's work going on right now of doing ex vivo CRISPR for gene editing, and then implantation of stem cells or things like that to try to resolve things like hemophilia or certain rare disorders where you don't have to have a whole lot of product. But the problem with CRISPR is, in order for it to work, you're going to have to do it on an embryo, which introduces a huge number of ethical considerations, not to mention just the technical ones of making sure that it goes right. So,
yeah, we certainly saw that. What was that, December 2019, I think, with the CRISPR babies out of China, the twins. Definitely a lot of implications there when we're talking about the embryo level. Any other thoughts, Dr. Arun, on CRISPR and genetic editing when it comes to like clinical trials?
Yeah, I think as Dr. Robson said, it's really a very advanced but new technology. So implementing it into genetics, germline or genomics, will take some time.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a good thing to keep our eye on. Right now, it's more on that scale. And another question is, with clinical trials, do most clinical trials for different cancer therapies, do they require that people have done genetic testing in order to get into the clinical trials? Can you guys provide a little bit more background on just the inclusion criteria for clinical trials?
I can start. So it depends on the clinical trials. So they are not all of them, obviously, but there are now recently more and more clinical trials for all solid tumors that most of them require somatic testing, especially if the trial is about targeted agents. That's happening more and more compared to traditional chemotherapeutic agents. With the germline clinical trials for treatment interventions, it's a little bit currently not all of them. I think it's a minority. Many trials obviously have included germline BRCA1 and 2 mutations for PARP inhibitor therapies, but that's now expanding to some other germline as well, PALB2, for example. But I think the majority of the clinical trials that require some type of molecular testing is really somatic testing for targeted therapies.
Yeah.
Dr. Robson on the,
Nothing to add. All depends on the trial. And I agree with Dr. Arun. Most trials do not require genetic testing to go on a trial. Yep. There are more and more targeted therapy trials that require somatic testing, but not necessarily germline.
Not all of them. Yeah. And I saw Dr. Robson, you were kind of commenting with someone in the chat there. Did you want to comment on that just on the show here of what they were talking about?
Yeah. I mean, Dr. Chan here is suggesting using, you know, a variety of informatics techniques to mine clinical records and then provide, provide decision support through the EMR to help with screening people for genetic testing and the like, which I think is a, you know, it's a great idea. Unfortunately, well, it's a great idea, period. Right now, most medical records are not structured in such a way that that's necessarily easy to do. We've been doing the AACR Genie project, which is a project looking at outcomes for somatic testing. And as part of that, been trying to find ways to mine from the medical record just whether or not genetic testing has been done. And it's unbelievably challenging because it goes in all kinds of different places and most of the reports are PDFs, which can't be scanned. You know, it's just really hard to do. So maybe in the future when we have the perfect EMR and connected nationally to a network of computers that can screen it, then it will work. But for now, I think it's kind of unlikely.
Yes, maybe we'll see phenotypes tips playing a role in that in just terms of EMRs and EHRs and just a lot of them not being designed for us folks in genetics. But exciting to see that there is the technology out there that hopefully we are being able to adapt a little bit more to. Anything else before we wrap up? I think somehow we have answered all of the questions coming in. You guys were very efficient today. So anything else before we close today?
No, thank you for the opportunity and you know, this very important topic.
Yeah, yes, thank you so much. Yeah, you guys have much expertise to provide, and it was just such a treat to be able to ask you all the questions that I had too. That you know, I haven't worked in cancer in a little bit. When I did, I was a student, so you know, it's very exciting just to hear where we are now, where we're headed in the future in terms of cancer genetics. You can also access all of our previous installments by going to phenotips.com, click the stories tab at the top, and then you'll see the speaker series pop up on the drop-down menu. And again, all the installments are there. You can also search Phenotips in your podcast player to listen to it that way. So stay tuned for our upcoming webinars coming in 2022. And if you've enjoyed this genetic conversation today, you might also enjoy my other podcast, DNA Today. You can search that on all podcast players or head over to dnapodcast.com. Dr. Arun, Dr. Robson, thank you so much for just providing so much expertise on cancer genetics, where we're headed. I think this is very timely content, and I just appreciate you guys could just answer all of my questions. You're really leaders in the field. So it was just so, so great to be able to speak with you guys about this today. So thank you so much for your time, especially the week of American Thanksgiving here.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, are all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.